You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's episode, sponsored by civic engagement podcast Future Hindsight. We're back with an all-new season on systemic racism in the U.S. Each week, they'll explore how the legacy of colonialism still permeates our country and how we can rectify it. This week, they explore the role of unconscious bias in early childhood education, how it can set up kids for failure before school even starts. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. And now, for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior national correspondent at HuffPost, author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare, and The Unfinished Crusade for Universal Healthcare, Jonathan Cohn will join us. Meanwhile, as the third vaccine begins distribution, White House brokers a deal with Merck to up production. Senate Democrats in final negotiations on the COVID-19 relief bill, looking for reoccurring payments and automatic unemployment extension. Third woman now accuses Andrew Cuomo of unwanted creepy physical advances. Bernie Sanders plans a $15 minimum wage amendment. His COBRA subsidies and union pension support survives the bird test. Jim Jordan and the Republicans want the House Judiciary Committee to hold a hearing and, yes, cancel culture. The Biden administration starts a Taliban negotiations. Ted Cruz's approval ratings go south after his Cancun jaunt. New Mexico Attorney General sues pharmaceutical maker Gilead over antitrust violations in production of HIV drugs. Trump administration siphoned money to fund Operation Warp Speed, leaving hospitals desperately underfunded during COVID. And lastly, Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas says the entire immigration system is broken and that they will allow separated families to reunite in the U.S. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you doing today?
Well, hanging in there. Good news, I guess, on the vaccination front. We're going to see more of those Johnson & Johnson vaccinations. And they're already being distributed as we speak. Unfortunately, some of the states are starting to take the good numbers a little too much to heart, and we're seeing a little bit of a plateau on the numbers across the country. This is happening across the in many respects across the world. I mean, people are just getting sick of everybody hits the wall. It feels like at the same time. Like every couple of months, it feels like there's another wall that you hit.
Yeah, and I think the winter weather is compounding that. It's making that wall even sturdier, I guess. Just I think everybody's so sick of being inside. It's understandable, but I mean, it can be alleviated by strong leadership by governors and lawmakers.
I mean, it's sometimes when you can sort of see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. It's not quite a light. It's more of like just a glow a little bit. But sometimes that makes you a little bit more impatient to get out there. And I feel like that's what's happening on a mass level Folks, still, you know, we're nearly there. And if folks continue to follow best practices, even after you get your vaccination, to help everybody get across the line, we could have a decent summer and maybe, you know, some type of, broadly speaking, more or less return to normalcy by fall. But we will see. In the meantime, there have been ongoing hearings on the Hill regarding the January 6th riot and attacks. A lot of news in the wake of that. Some of the far right groups are splintering, according to the New York Times, in wake of the Capitol riot. They all have a different idea of how they can be white nationalists or white supremacists or, thugs or whatever. Like they all have different perspectives on that, and they all want to be heard. And so you're going to get a lot more splintering of groups. Meanwhile, John Brennan. Let's play this clip of John Brennan. It is fascinating how some people are using, and well, look, we've seen this with the whole Never Trumper phenomenon, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that John Brennan could be considered a Never Trumper. I mean, I think he identifies, I don't know, as a Democrat or maybe an independent. But he was the former CIA director. And before he was the CIA director, he was head of counterterrorism under Barack Obama. And before he was head of counterterrorism under Barack Obama, he was at the CIA during the torture regime of George W. Bush. And, well, let's just listen to see. You would imagine someone who has been involved in endorsing the torture regime, in setting up the drone assassination program, which killed not only an American that was supposedly targeted, but also his 16-year-old son at a later date that was supposedly a mistake. His daughter has since been killed too, a young child, American born. You would imagine this is a guy who would have a lot of things that he would be embarrassed about. But is it any of those things? No, it is not.
That's why we started with Katie Benner's great new reporting about the investigation into police officer. It renders, at best hypocritical, at worst cynical and false, any notion that the Republicans care about the lives and the safety of law enforcement.
Well, I must say, to Claire's point, I'm increasingly embarrassed to be a white male these days. And what light of what I see of my other white males saying, but it just shows that with very few exceptions like Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, there are so few Republicans in Congress who value truth, honesty, and integrity. And so they'll continue to gaslight the country the way that Donald Trump did. And the fact that this has such security and safety implications for the American public and for the members of Congress, again, as Claire said, it is just a disgusting display of craven politics that really should have no place in the United States in 2021.
It is. And I just want to point a couple of things out. When you talk about gaslighting, the Cheney family gaslighted this country in a myriad ways, but one of the big ones was the Iraq War. And the entire neoconservative movement. I mean, it's just I appreciate that Lynn Cheney voted for impeachment. That was the right thing to do. But the idea that all of this stuff is forgiven because you're against Donald Trump or because you're breaking from a Republican Party that is that nurtured all of this, nurtured all of it. Let's remember, Mitt Romney flew to New York to kiss Donald Trump's ring during his run for president in 2000.
Or after he'd already won. After he'd already won, he kissed his ring in order to get the Secretary of State position, which Trump obviously did.
Yes, but
not
I'm
give
talking about in a position where he, you know, where there was no like, well, maybe if I get on the inside, I can lessen the damage. When he was running as a nominee, he went and gave his prestige to Donald Trump as some type of signifier in terms of Donald Trump's status. And so you have a guy here. And when we talk about gaslighting the country, also remember that John Brennan oversaw the spying on Senate staffers who were digging around trying to find information about the torture regime.
Yep.
So much so that Dianne Feinstein, I remember the day Dianne Feinstein like had this sort of like impromptu, I think it was a press conference where she said like, this is the most disturbing thing I've ever seen in the Senate.
Well, because then they're being spied upon. They have very little regard for when our intelligence agencies were spying on American citizens with impunity and illegality. But then, of course, when the Senate and Congress is affected, yes, they're very concerned. Look at how John Brennan centers himself here. This is a lot of what you see with white centrist liberals. I mean, I guess he's a conservative, but people who want to appear like they're sensitive to race and want to appear like they're, repentant for the sins of white people and the fact that we enslave black people in this country, and they try to appear a certain way. You're still centering yourself by making it about your basically white guilt. And that's really what he's doing there. It's signaling to the audience there, I'm a good guy because I recognize this, as opposed to looking at it from a systemic lens, which he's not going to do, because the CIA has been, as has been documented throughout history, instrumental in upholding white supremacy. But I guess he washes it all away by centering himself and saying, look how woke I am, by making that throwaway comment, not looking at his own role in upholding white supremacy and systemic racism as a part of the institution he was instrumental in and did all of those horrible things, as you mentioned, Sam, for years and years and years.
And I think the reason why this resonates, you know, you can go back, I don't know, I can't even remember how many days ago it was. Just a couple of days ago, we interviewed an author of the book of Identity Capitalism. And we just saw that in action there, where they're going to, in some fashion or another, roll out this. And yes, you know, there's many reasons to feel embarrassed that you're a white male at various times. But if you have been involved in what he's been involved with, there's a lot of other things that are just
I don't even
important.
Think it's embarrassing, Sam. I think if your ideology and if you're trying to work for things that are correct and just, you don't need to kind of make that over the top gesture. I mean, that's just a way to essentially virtue signal. And again, make your own, you know, personal belief that, oh, you're repentant and, oh, look at me. Look, I have these woke views, making yourself the center of attention, as opposed to actually looking at the structures, which would be constructive. He's not interested in that.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the senior national correspondent of the HuffPost and the author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare, The Unfinished Crusade for Universal Healthcare, Jonathan Cohn. Meantime, Magic Spoon is the cereal that has amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. Em and I are already smiling because I just finished off part of the last I had of the gingerbread, which was a specialty flavor, but that's not the point. With Magic Spoon, there's 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, and only 140 calories a serving. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free, soy free, low carb, and it's GMO free. And Magic Spoon will be releasing 2 amazing flavors this month for a limited time only. I have already ordered these. This is not part of the copy, but apparently you can sign up to get the VIP treatment where they text it to you. And I think you were there when I was doing that. Cookies and cream and maple waffle. And that's for the kids. Now, I mean, I'm still a cinnamon guy, although I'm
I know, but that fruity, I thought it might be too fruity for me, like, and it wasn't. It was just right. It was really, really good. I think I have a new favorite.
Now, you can also build your own box with these flavors: cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, and cinnamon. And if you're listening from Canada, Magic Spoon now ships there too. Look, I have become a cereal eater again, but my kids love the cereal, and it makes me feel good that I'm giving them something that isn't full of sugar and that they like it. For me, it is, I have to say, cinnamon, peanut butter, cocoa. Those are my my faves in order. You can go to magicspoon.com/majority report. Grab the new limited edition cookies and cream maple waffle, a custom bundle of cereal, to try it today. Be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout, and you save $5 off your order. This offer is now good anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, but only when you use our code at checkout. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report, save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this podcast and, frankly, my breakfast almost every single day. Too often, we got to choose between quality or a fair price. Well, here's the good news when it comes to shaving. With Harry's, you don't have to choose. Harry's gives you award-winning blades at factory direct prices. And for a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/majority.
I gotta say, my significant other uses that body wash and he loves it so much. The shishu flavor. So there you go.
There you go.
Like, I'm authentic. I love it. It smells good.
You should check out what he's doing, though. He's talking about it as a flavor.
Did I say flavor?
Yeah.
I got Magic Spoon on the brain.
Harry's, I've been using Harry's for years now, and it's true. During COVID in particular, my shaving is down to rarely. But when I do, Harry's delivers me a close, comfortable shave, and they do so at an incredibly fair price, only $2 per refill. Harry's believes in quality so much, they bought their own factory in Germany so they could own every step of the manufacturing process. And of course, the savings get passed on to you. Their German factory is one of the few manufacturers in the world that have mastered the technology to create a Gothic arch. It's the gold standard for razor blade grinding. I don't know. The blades are great. The razors, the handles are, you know, sort of classic looking. They're not all buffy like those weird ones that you get in the store. They don't come in the huge plastic containers. I don't have to go to the store to get them. They send them right to me. Super convenient. Just a good value. And if you don't like what they're sending you, you have 100% money back guarantee on harrys.com. For a limited time, Harry's has an exclusive offer for our listeners. On this show, new customers can get a Harry starter set and a free body wash for just $3 at harrys.com/majority. That's over $16 value for just $3. You get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, a travel cover, travel size body wash. It's an incredibly great deal, but act fast while supplies last. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer. And lastly, folks, everybody's shopping online these days, obviously. It's an easy thing to do. My kid is now, that's basically, you know, she's a little bit anxious about getting COVID, doesn't want to go into stores at the moment. Good for her, but she does all her shopping online. For both of us, and I've told this story where I like taught her, like when she first bought something, like, God, always search for the coupon code because you save $5. And just trying to give her some sense of, like, you know, it's not play money, even though you get most of it from your dad. But that all became super easy thanks to Honey. You no longer have to manually search for coupon codes. That's a thing of the past. Honey is a free browser extension. It scours the internet for promo codes. It applies the best one automatically and applies it to your cart. Supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products to fashion brands, even food delivery. Imagine you're shopping on one of your favorite sites. When you check out, the Honey button drops down. All you have to do is click apply coupons. Boom. You wait a few seconds. Honey drops the price if they find a working coupon. It's found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. I texted Mila this morning to find out like what her last purchase was. And because she uses Honey. And I said, what was the last thing you bought? She's like, I don't know. And I'm like, well, just tell me something. She goes, I don't remember. And so I have to go back to the last thing, which was, do you remember what it was like a some serum at some place, like a Aura or something like that?
You explained it to me last time.
But yeah, she said $15, she saved $5 off it.
Yeah.
And that's real money, folks.
I use Honey too. I'm trying to find my last purchase, but
if you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. Okay. Want to welcome to the program. We have him. Okay, great. Senior national correspondent. The HuffPost, the author of his most recent, The 10-Year War, Obamacare, and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Healthcare. Jonathan Cohn, welcome to the program, if we have you.
You do.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, wow. That timing worked perfectly, too.
That was perfect. Miracle Jonathan, good to see you. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
How are you doing, Jonathan?
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on your latest book. You're not quite at a trilogy yet, but hope springs eternal, I guess. All right, let's start with this. Now, this is basically a TikTok is obviously doesn't do it justice, but you walk through the process of how you're basically looking at how the sausage is made, and when it comes to Obamacare, the ACA. Before we get into that, I want you to set just give us a little bit of background on what happened in 1993, because so much of what happened in 2008, 9, 10, and 11, I guess, or 10, really, with the ACA was influenced by what happened in 1993.
Yeah, can I say, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's such an important part of the book. And there's that's where the book really starts. And that was a very deliberate choice. The story of the ACA, right, is this long running crusade to get to universal coverage, sort of being, running up against the history of failure. And the 1993 failure, was cataclysmic politically and left this deep psychic scar on the Democratic Party. And just to, you remember this, but I don't know how many of your listeners do. I'm conscious of the fact that I'm older than I used to be.
Same,
I guess we're all older. People forget, Bill Clinton gets elected. It's like this really exciting moment for Democrats. I mean, they've basically been locked out of the White House since the 60s, except for the fluke of the Jimmy Carter election. They've been on the defensive. And here's this young, energetic president. He's like literally shook Kennedy's hand. He's the new generation of healthcare is going to be big thing. He gives this big speech in front of Congress. Hillary Clinton, who is like, goes to testify, which has really never been done this way before. And she like wows all the committees because she's the one in charge of writing the bill. And it really looked like this thing was going to happen. And then it just fell apart.
What was it, though? I mean, tell people what it was, because I don't think people remember. I mean, this was, on some level, and I don't know, maybe there's a different book about this, about what that lesson taught the Clintons in that moment and how they shifted, Bill Clinton shifted his presidency. But that was an aggressive bill. I mean, that was a good bill.
I wrote at the time when they were debating the Affordable Care Act that, we're going to miss the Clinton health care plan, because that was a better on paper. That was a better health care plan. I mean, it was more comprehensive, more aggressive, really would have gotten, close to truly universal coverage, really tried to get into the guts of a lot of what was wrong with the health care system. But they ran into a bunch of problems. And afterwards, the people who worked on it really just obsessively sat down, and I don't mean that in a bad sense obsessively, but they said, like, what did we do wrong and how can we do better next time? And they kind of drew a set of lessons from that. And, some of them were substantive. So like the most important lesson I think they took
as a substantive lesson was the Clinton healthcare plan would have moved a lot of people who had employer coverage into something new. And the theory was it would be better. The Clinton healthcare was going to give you a better healthcare plan than when you got from your employer. I think it probably would have been. I think, you know, they really put a lot of thought into what these plans would look like. Problem was people got spooked. If you, you know, it doesn't matter that people thought their employer plans, they didn't like them, or they were getting too expensive, or they knew they could lose it with their job. You know, as soon as it became a real possibility to lose that plan and get something new, that they freaked out. So the conclusion was, don't do that again. Try not to disrupt if you can avoid it, and especially don't disrupt employer plans. And by the way, employers don't want to get rid of them either, and that's a whole other story. So, you know, don't do that. Relatedly, as a kind of more of a strategic approach, but also that would affect the policy, you're not going to win a war with the healthcare industry. You know, they got killed by the drug industry. They got killed by the insurance industry. And so the calculation was the only, and this, remember, it was not the first time. Harry Truman gets killed by the American Medical Association. And the, you know, the only way through is to sit down with these groups and say, look, this healthcare system is unstable. It's not ideal for you either. Let's figure out a way that you can give up a little. Maybe we'll pay you a little less here. We'll pay you differently there. And then we can use that savings to kind of some of that to sort of help people get insurance who don't have it now. So they were going to negotiate. It was not going to be an all-out war with the healthcare industry. And then there were a number of other lessons. But, you know, the two other big broad ones were stay away from big government. You know, big government scares people. It may not scare people in practice, right? Everyone likes their Medicare, but they don't like the idea of big government. They don't like the idea of big taxes and regulation. And then recognize the fact you're probably going to have to get at least some Republican buy-in at some point. So be on the lookout for a way to do that. And I really, truly think, just as a lesson in terms of how the sausage gets made, this is like, I don't want to get into a meatpacking analogy here, but, you know, the whole first third of the book, I spent a lot of time on all these sort of tasks. They were very unglamorous. You know, it was wonks going to conferences, and it was these meetings in hotel rooms with interest groups. So like, all this stuff meant that when the Democrats got to 2007, 2008, they were really ready to move. And they'd already worked out the big questions among themselves, for better or worse, on right. what a new system was going to look like.
Let me, and before we get to that, when we get up to that, but in terms of the lessons that they learned, and maybe this is sort of like, you know, outside of the portfolio, because I mean, if you're not, you know, I mean, you had covered 2007, 2008. I mean, you were on this beat at that time, and you were really on that beat. I mean, it wasn't, you were, even at that time, and you and I are, yeah, similar age. I'm probably a little bit older myself, but you weren't a neophyte. And so, but in 93, do you think that was the lesson? I mean, what the lessons that Democrats internalized, at least the, you know, the people who were sort of like going to be involved in that process, did they internalize, do you have the ability to assess whether they learned the right lessons? Because I mean, all I remember from that era, and I was Hillary Care was the way that they attacked this. It was Hillary Care. And they would already had set up that Hillary Clinton was the first lady who was not going to stay in the kitchen. And it was extremely gendered. I don't think there was, you know, and it was extremely there was a lot of active pushback on the sort of, I mean, that's when Limbaugh was, you know, introduced feminazi. I mean, that time was, it was very, very gendered, the whole thing. And I wonder if the lessons that they learned were somewhat trying to, you know, sort of like not acknowledging, like, this was more of just sort of like a political messaging thing, or there was a lot of like tinder there for these outside groups to sort of light on fire, and it was going to catch quickly.
Yeah. So I think they certainly learned that they should not expect a lot of cooperation, and they should expect whatever they put out there was going to generate this very hostile pushback from a part of the Republican Party that was always there, but was getting more vocal, more extreme in its tactics, more extreme in its ideology. You know, I really do think the origins of so much of what we see, even, you know, not to zoom ahead in the story, but what we see today and what we saw with Trump, so much of it, it has its origins in the 90s and that sort of that toxic mix of gender. It's gendered. It's got a racial layer to it. Right. Yep. And this sort of this desire to fight, declare Democrats enemy of the people. I mean, that all goes back to like Newt Gingrich. Right. I mean, he's really the pioneer there. And a lot of it actually starts in the fight over the Clinton health care plan. And I do wonder sometimes, I think, you know, the people who were the architects of the Affordable Care Act, and there's different kinds of architects, right? I mean, there's policy intellectuals, there's strategists. You know, I think the strategists in particular were not naive about the opposition they would face. That said, I don't think they fully appreciated the depth of it or how much it could consume the entire party. There was this hope all along that there was a small remaining group within the Republican Party that was not signing up for this, that was still more of the old statesman model, you know, the moderates, the people who made deals, who there. And in fact, the 90s thing, I mean, it's interesting because if you go back to the Clinton plan, I mean, one of the sort of after action conclusions they came to was actually there was in 1993 a core group of conservative Republicans who seemed interested. And had they reached out to them earlier, they might have come to a deal. And in fact, there's a scene in the book, it comes much later, but it's in the early 2009, and Rahm Emanuel, who's the chief of staff, and of course was, I think, more than anyone in the White House, kind of carried the scars of the Clinton fight because he was political director in the Clinton White House. He's interviewing Nancy Ann DeParle, who's going to end up coming on board to run the healthcare effort. And he says to her, you know, they were talking about what they think they got wrong in 1993, because she had actually worked in the Clinton administration also. And he says, let's pinky promise that next time around, we won't fail to engage the Republicans early enough. And I think there was a sense that they knew this beast was out there, right? They knew this animal, but I think they still thought there was enough room to get some Republican buy-in. And of course, that was very much the lesson of the Massachusetts reforms, which were so important, as important, I think, as the Clinton reforms.
Okay. So, and we should say, so going forward or backwards at this point to 2007, I distinctly remember that campaign. It was sort of fascinating. You had three major candidates, by January, Edwards, Clinton, and Obama. And you could barely slide a piece of paper between them when it came to, they all signed out. I think it was Hacker's, right? It was Jacob Hacker's plan. And you couldn't slide a piece of paper between them in terms of the difference in the way that they signed on to that one plan. The only difference, as far as I remember, was Clinton was for the mandate and Obama was not for the mandate. But they were all, everybody was on board. Everything else was the same, as far as I recall. And there was still, you have the left was still pushing Medicare for all, but it was almost like the three frontrunners had congealed and like, we're going to agree to this. We've already boxed out Medicare for all or single payer. I think, you know, we referred to it at that time. We're going forward with it. They all basically ran on the exact same healthcare plan. And on some level, though, that's what, but it gave it the impetus to actually happen on some level, it feels like.
Yeah, that consensus, which really existed, I mean, it really gelled in 2006. And it was a combination, again, of these principles they'd all agreed on what they've gotten wrong, and then Mitt Romney in Massachusetts signing a plan like that and it becoming law. And I can't overstate. It was very important. it weighed heavily on everybody. Every Democrat saw that. And they saw that there was a Republican governor signing it. They saw that the Heritage Foundation had scholars praising it. They saw Ted Kennedy, patron saint of universal coverage, standing on the podium next to Romney. It was like, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And of course, that didn't come out of nowhere. That plan had grown, the same people, many of the same people working on that were the same people who were writing in the journals, and people like Jonathan Gruber, the economist from Massachusetts. And you get to 2007, they're all on the same page. And the liberals are mostly on the same page, too. I mean, remember, Ted Kennedy is, you know, very liberal. I mean, Ted Kennedy would love to have a single payer system. But Ted Kennedy says, you know what, we're not going to get that. This is the best we can do. I think there are two factors in terms of the left boxing out Medicare for all. The first is they did have this public option idea, which was from Jacob Hacker, which was very much meant to be a kind of recognition that this is not the kind of plan most liberals would like. But by doing a public option, we kind of get our foot in the door here. We sort of have like a demonstration version of a single payer, and hopefully over time it grows. So number one, there was that. But number two, I think the psychology, we've been talking about the effect of the Clinton plan in terms of policy levers. Okay, do this, don't do that, structure your taxes this way, whatever. The psychological effect on so many older, and I do mean older Democrats who had been working on this for their entire lives was so important. You had Ted Kennedy, who, of course, in 2008 is, you know, eventually diagnosed with brain cancers. Henry Waxman, who's been, you know, warrior on healthcare his entire career, finding every little hole he can to expand Medicaid or whatever. All these guys who were liberals who would have wanted to do Medicare for all if it was up to them, or even Obama, who always described himself as a single payer guy. But Obama's younger. All of them just saying, you know, Waxman, Kennedy, John Dingell, who was my congressman in Michigan, recognizing this may be our last shot. We don't want, you know, we're going to take a second, third, fourth, fifth best solution. And for better or worse, right? I mean, the bad news is you locked out Medicare for all. I mean, that was not, for all intents and purposes, was not even in the conversation. The benefit was they were united. They were ready to go. And there was really very little daylight between, you know, again, Ted Kennedy, very liberal, and Max Baucus, the very conservative Senate finance chairman. We're basically in the same place. And all three candidates, like you said, we're in this, you know, John Edwards, people forget about John Edwards, who was actually the first one to do a plan. John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama. The only meaningful difference between them was, as you said, that Obama had a mandate for kids, but not adults. Hillary had a mandate. And I will say, as someone, you know, I covered that, you know, we spent months writing about that difference. Yeah. And, you know, it is a sort of, I look back and like, okay, maybe that wasn't such an important difference after all.
All right. One thing you mentioned, Waxman, the story you tell with Waxman and Dingell, I found that fascinating because it's one of those situations where you forget the, like, they're like, you know, legacy decisions and interests and this and that always have, it's not even unintended consequences because there was no intention of consequence in that. But talk about, you know, what Waxman ran into on the Energy and Commerce Committee. I mean, how he replaced Dingell and how Dingell had gotten people on there that were inadvertently hostile to what Waxman was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dingell, like Kennedy, is a longtime champion of universal coverage. His father, John Dingell Sr., is the author of what's considered the first really serious bill in Congress in the 1940s to create a universal healthcare plan. And every, you know, he's passionate about this. He's the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over healthcare. It also has jurisdiction over energy policy. John Dingell from Michigan, the auto industry. I say that as someone who lives in his old district. On climate, you know, he had a mix. You know, his record was mixed over the years. I think he did, you know, back some environmental measures, but certainly when it came to like emissions, you know, he was an ally of the auto industry fighting against people who wanted to lower emissions, you know, and sort of put new rules on the auto industry. Who was leading that fight? Henry Waxman, who was also on the Energy and Commerce Committee. Now you get to 2008 and Waxman decides to challenge Dingell for the committee. And there were a lot of reasons why, you know, these challenges, there's personalities, whatever. Dingell had been there for a while. Waxman ends up winning and becomes the chairman of the committee. And so as they're writing the Affordable Care Act, he's presiding over these committee hearings, but he's got a committee that, you know, Dingell as the committee chair had put a lot of people on the committee who he knew would be allies on these environmental policies. So they're a little more conservative. Well, these folks, now they're doing healthcare. Waxman is trying to push a more liberal version of healthcare reform. And these conservatives are pushing back. And we really see the kind of conflict come into play over what we were talking about before, which is the public option. Henry Waxman really wants a public option. You know, he's a believer in it. He would love to get to single payer someday. But he's got to get this thing out of committee and he doesn't have the votes. And it's not, and you can't say, well, just go, you know, bypass the committee or something. Because among other things, that committee is a pretty good proxy for what the House Democratic Caucus as a whole looks like. So, I mean, if he can't get it through his committee, Nancy Pelosi is going to have a real hard time getting the full bill. To top things up, to make things more complicated, people forget this about the early Obama administration. They say, why weren't they more ambitious about things? They were very ambitious, right? They did this big, what was considered a big stimulus at the time. And then they didn't just do healthcare. They were trying to do climate also. They had a cap and trade bill they were trying to push through. And the House passed that bill with Obama and Pelosi and Waxman twisting arms, you know, lobbying hard. Well, here comes along healthcare now in the Energy and Commerce Committee. And suffice to say, a lot of these conservative Democrats who weren't happy about that, they're in no mood to play nice on the public option. And so basically, that forces Waxman, when he gets the bill out of, to get his bill out of committee, he has to bargain away a lot of things. And one of them is that he does get a public option, but it's a really weak version of one. I mean, very scaled back. And that is, of course, a precursor for what's going to happen later in the process when eventually they're actually going to just drop it altogether.
Okay. So, I mean, just that dynamic in and of itself, like tells like almost like the, so many lessons that come out of that. But when you say like these guys were, and I feel like, you know, when we jump over to the Senate, we start talking about Joe Lieberman, like this comes in, this is like, I think contemporaneously when I realize like, oh my God, I can't believe it. That these guys are making decisions on some really petty stuff in their mind, like for petty reasons in my mind that have massive implications to for millions of people and the trajectory of the country in many respects. So when you say like, okay, so the cap and trade is there. And I think that was around the time Joe Manchin famously shot it, the bill with a semi-automatic weapon in an advertisement in a campaign ad.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
And so, you know, just to remind people. And so people are feeling like, is it that their donors on that committee are getting at them? Or are they just like, you know what? I've gone to bat for you. I mean, I always have a certain amount of donor pressure and my tolerance to go back and make extra calls and find other donors or my fear that they're going to come after me is such that I'm not willing to do this for you because you've already asked too much for me. Like the favor's got to flow both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. So
is it that petty?
So I'll say this. So first of all, I try to be really careful, and I tried in the book to be really careful about this also, not to sort of state what motives were people, because I can't see into people's heads. You know, I never know. My sense, and I don't know what your sense is, and I'd be interested to hear this, but my sense, having covered politics this many years now, is that it will vary from individual to individual, and everybody's got a bunch of motives going on. So if you're, let's take a prototypical, you know, conservative Democrat in the House in 2009, you know, who is resisting the public option. And what are the possible reasons? Well, it could be they are philosophically conservative. They think big government is bad. The market is good. They think this is an intrusion. They have a more practical version of that, which is, gee, the way the public option works and the reason it seems like such an appealing idea is that it pays less to the hospitals and it pays less to the drug makers. I think that's actually bad for innovation. That's bad for, you know, it's going to cost jobs. A more parochial version of that is, that hospital in my district, that CEO just visited me. He told me he's going to lay off a bunch of people. And by the way, all his friends aren't going to give me money. And by the way, the American Hospital Association is going to spend $10 million on an ad buy in my district fighting me. Or, you know, then there's a whole other political concerns is, well, you know, truth be told, I think this makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, have you looked at my district lately? I'm in a Republican leaning district. My voters have already been told that public option is like socialized medicine and they'll never get their cure for cancer. I can't be seen voting for this, and I can't be seen lining up for something that Henry Waxman, oh my God, Henry Waxman or Ted Kennedy or Nancy Pelosi likes. So, or that president who's, I have a lot of conservative white constituents and that president who is not white backs, and I can't do that either. And you know, you could any mix of these, I think, and then you do get into the petty stuff. I think, you know, again, I think we see a lot of this when we get to the Senate potentially. And again, I can't see into anybody's brain, but you sort of look at the interplay between leadership and a few senators in particular, and you do start to wonder how much of that got personal.
Yeah, I mean, I think any given person has all of those elements in it. It's just a question of one person has, you know, a little bit more green, another has a little more blue, a little more has like a red, and that's the color that comes out when they vote. All right, so let's and just to be clear on the public option. The public option would have applied, and just so the people know when we talk about the ACA, because I think there's still, you know, I mean, I think there's a presumption that everybody knows, but the ACA has really three major components. One is the patient protection part of the bill. It was officially the PPACA. Personally, I think that was the biggest mistake they ever made because they delivered on the PP part. They didn't deliver on the ACA part. Frankly, like the patient protections, that's what Nancy Pelosi, that's what they ran on in 2018, pre-existing conditions. These are all the protections that are in the bill. And then there's the patient protections. There's the exchange, which at any time only was going to affect the maximum projections were something like 20, 30 million Americans. And then the 20 or 30 million Americans who would have gotten expansion of Medicaid, presuming that you didn't have lunatics as governors in a dozen more states. And so for the vast majority of people in this country, it wouldn't have had really much implication, except for the public option might have, right?
So it depends on which iteration you're talking about.
Right.
So, I mean, when Jacob Hacker, who you mentioned for your listeners and viewers, is a professor at Yale who studies the sort of history of healthcare and got very involved in crafting policy. His original suggestion was that a public option would be a sort of government plan open to anybody. Now, by the time we get to 2007, 2008, that's already been downsized a lot. They've already sort of said, no, it's just, at least for now, it'll just be open to people buying coverage on their own through the exchanges. And again, this is very tied into the Clinton, don't mess with people's health. You know, it doesn't matter if you're offering a better alternative, just you got to be able to say to people with employer coverage, we're not going to take away your coverage. And so that's how that got downsized. And then as it went through the process, it got sort of chipped away, like the features of it, et cetera, and then at the end, they get rid of it altogether. The original iteration, though, it would have been available to anybody. And that is very much still in play right now when you look at some of the proposals. I think we're a ways from having the votes for those. But, you know, in terms of what you see getting talked about within the Democratic Party, there's a lot of new interest in something that would be open to everybody.
That's Medicare for all who want it, essentially.
Basically, yeah.
I mean, you know, some iteration of that.
Yes.
Okay, so let's jump over to the Senate. What do you think about that with the PPACA dichotomy? Like, they sold it on the affordability, and it never delivered really on that. But it did deliver for every American the idea that there's no rescission, the idea there's no lifetime caps or yearly caps, the idea that there's no pre-existing conditions, the idea that you can be on your policy until you're 26, you know, your parents' policy until you're 26. And these are all things that people were material benefits for people that ended up being, when they tried to repeal it, the go-to that the Democrats would talk about. I mean, particularly pre-existing conditions.
So I don't know if I would qualify that. I have a slightly different take on that. So I agree with the first part about the protection part. And I think it's been politically like a home run, right? I mean, you see that now, Republicans bending over backwards. We support pre-existing, you know, protecting people with pre-existing conditions. That's like that is the surest sign that is a Rubicon that's been crossed now and we're not going back. So, you know, unless the Supreme Court decides to throw it out. That's another story. So I agree with all of that. On the affordability part, I think it would be my take is that it delivered on affordability for a lot of people, but not for everybody. And there's a large number of people who didn't. And I certainly, you know, in the book, I bend over backwards really to talk about the people who still don't have affordable insurance. And that includes people who had what they thought was affordable coverage before. You know, because, you know, their plans were super cheap. Now, those plans, I would tell you, you know, if you look at it, you'd say those plans were super cheap because you couldn't get them with a pre-existing condition. And if you got real sick, you were in trouble. But, you know, if you stayed healthy, you didn't know that and it got you paid your doctor bills. But I do think, you know, as much time as was spent on that, and I think politically it was a huge issue, and I think it's a very real inadequacy, failing of the Affordable Care Act. you do have to weigh that against the fact that a ton of people, even in the exchanges, are saving, are got much cheaper coverage, especially because of the way the law is structured, is you get to kind of the middle, lower middle end of, you know, people who are getting a lot of tax credits. I mean, the coverage they're getting in a lot of cases is quite affordable with low cost sharing. And then, of course, the Medicaid part, like, it gets forgotten. I mean, it got so little attention in 2009 and 2010. And it's been huge and amazing. The biggest problem, as you said, is that you got a bunch of Republican officials blocking it in states. But, you know, that's been, you know, we first it was sort of moderate Republican governors like in Ohio and Michigan, Arizona, they sort of embraced it and it came to those states. Now we're seeing in the states that are holding out like ballot petitions. I mean, Idaho, they got right. Medicaid expansion because the voters want it. You know, Florida, Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, those states still don't have it. Literally millions of people could get insurance, but, you know, it's getting there.
I guess my point was, if you're in the exchanges, you're saving money, you're getting the subsidies up to 400%. They're right. talking about, and I think in this COVID relief bill, they're actually like raising that threshold. I'm not sure what the number is. Maybe we don't know yet, but it's going to be over 400%. You're going to be eligible subsidies. But then you're only talking about, you know, like I say, 20 or 30 million people tops right. who would be available for that. Everybody else has still got their employer-based coverage.
Oh, sure. yep.
And they're like, that the affordable part didn't apply to me. But yep. the patient protection applied to everybody, and they never sold that part. They dropped the PP from the name, and the Medicaid was completely undersold, it seems to me. And, like, do you have a sense of why they did that? Just because, you know, affordability, they knew that affordability was important, but there was never even a plan other than maybe broadly, slightly bending the curve of everybody's cost of healthcare. There was no plan to really sort of like provide a material, something that I could look at and say, it was never even contemplated that somebody on employer-based healthcare coverage would look at their bill and say like, hey, my insurance is cheaper. Like, you could say, my insurance didn't go up at the rate of increase that it did in the past 5 years, but you would never say my insurance is cheaper. And so you didn't, like, there is no way, unless you follow this stuff, to know that
yeah.
what they meant by affordable.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, this goes back to the original decision they made. You can't change what you don't change. If you're not going to mess with employer coverage, you know, you're not going to take it away from people and you can reassure them that way. But it also means you're not giving them something obvious as a benefit. There are lots of ways to deliver savings to people who had employer coverage, but they all involve changing employer coverage, which, you know, now you're back. It's like you go back to rule number one, don't mess with employer coverage. I think that's why, to some extent, going forward, I mean, it's interesting. I think there's more interest in doing something on employer coverage now. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders makes this point all the time. He's very good at this. You know, he says, people say you can't change your employer coverage. Who likes their employer coverage? So I think that conversation is shifting. That said, the reality is, if you look at the polling, we've still, I think, got a ways to go because people are scared of change. I mean, that works left, right. It's just the case. And so, yeah, I mean, they kind of got stuck. I do think the Biden administration, you look at their plans, they are trying to figure out ways that they can get help to people with employer coverage. And you're going to see some of that happen if they can get it through Congress. And there, you know, some of it is like, we're going to work on the price of prescription drugs separately. And, you know, if we can do this public option, I mean, they do have this one, it doesn't get a lot of attention, but one of Biden's ideas was to say, you know, previously, one of the reasons you couldn't get a better deal if you weren't had employer coverage was if you had an employer option, you weren't eligible for subsidies. So like, let's say your employer plan costs, you know, so much money and you're looking over and given your income, you could get a better deal buying insurance over here on the exchange. You couldn't get that better deal. You weren't eligible for it. Biden wants to tear that down. Now that will get complex and it will cost money and it will have effects on employer coverage. So we'll be back into that very debate. But, you know, that's one way to do it.
Well, what's your sense of the public option fight going forward here? Because we have seen that the Biden administration kind of learned at least some lessons from what we saw in the Obamacare fight, right? Where they're Yep. just going to pass this $1.9 trillion stimulus through reconciliation without any Republican votes. There were zero Republican votes on this bill in the House. And so there are going to be multiple reconciliation attempts, although that's limited. Do you sense that the Biden administration is going to fight for a public option in any way? I mean, I would imagine that it would be at least a year or two down the line after we've kind of gotten through this pandemic. What's your sense on the lessons that his Democratic Party has learned and the Biden administration specifically on dealing with Republicans on this issue?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. I'd say there's sort of factors pushing in either direction. So on the one hand, going through a pandemic does tend to focus the mind on healthcare, right? So, I mean, I think there's a sense that they need to do something aggressive on healthcare, even beyond what they're doing with the COVID bill, beyond what they're doing with the regulations they can change. Politically, the progressive wing of the party is louder, more organized. It's got more information at its disposal. They are going to push in that direction. And I think the Biden administration has a very good sense of that flank of the party. I think they feel, even if they wanted to stiff it, I think they would know they can't. I think as a policy lesson, I think a lot of the people working on healthcare policy who were a little dismissive of the idea of a public option in the past are now coming around to the idea as a good idea. So that all pushes in the direction of, yes, they would do it. You know, the flip side is, number one, there's priorities, right? You know, and there's only so many places you're going to have a knockdown fight. Are they going to put a public option above minimum wage? Are they going to put it in front of climate change, in front of infrastructure? I kind of don't think so. And now you've kind of, you know, there's only so much bandwidth and only so much time.
Well, it seems like the minimum wage fight is at least delayed, if not, I don't know. I mean, given up on in some fashion, given what the parliamentarian ruled on, but maybe, I don't know.
Right. Right. I mean, at best, right. I mean, if they're going to come back to it, it's going to have to be a whole new fight right now. It's going to have to be separate from the COVID bill. So, I mean, that's a month or that's 2 months. So, you know, I think there's a question of the priorities. Biden himself is kind of interesting. And that, you know, he's never been a healthcare person. I mean, you can go back and look at his 2008 campaign. He was like one of, you know, the Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Barack Obama, very all in on healthcare. You know, Biden was like, yeah, I'll do it. I mean, it's just not his thing. It's just not his passion. It hasn't been. And he was actually among the advisors, and he had plenty of company, among the advisors urging Obama in late 2008, early 2009, not to do an aggressive push on healthcare because he thought it'd be such a political quagmire, which, to be fair, it was. But, you know, I do think just listening to him, watching him, knowing his feelings about caregiving and having dealt with, you know, his son's experience with cancer, that does seem to have like tuned him in more. I mean, I do think he seems to be thinking about healthcare more, and of course the pandemic. So I think it really is hard to know. You know, I think a lot of it's going to be the political pressure from the progressive wing of the party. How much do they, you know, want this? And I assume the progressive wing of the party, for them, it's going to be a calculation based in part on what else they're seeing. I mean, if, you know, Biden's all in on a Green New Deal, they'll probably cut him a lot of slack on healthcare. If he's not doing anything on the Green New Deal, then I think they're going to put more pressure on a public option.
One of the things that came out in your conversation with Obama as you did the reporting for the book, the concept, and I remember this, you know, contemporaneously, the idea was like, look, we passed the thing, it becomes like Medicare, you know, which wasn't Medicare day one. It took a while to evolve, but it becomes so embraced by the American public that there's no resistance to it. And then you can come in, you can do the technical fixes. And that was the plan. And that all seemed to me to be part of Barack Obama and that administration's sort of like lack of awareness of who the Republican Party had become or what the Republican Party had become at that point. And I think he's expressed, you know, surprised. Do you think that that lesson has been internalized by these people who do, you know, these policy political people that like, look, if we're going to do something, we're going to pay a big price regardless, you know, and you could say the same thing about the stimulus, right? Like, all right, you got to say it wasn't $1 trillion, but so what? Because they said it was $1 trillion. Like, I mean, do you think that lesson has been learned? Like, if we're going to go, you know, I mean, it's sort of Machiavelli, right? If you're going to do the king an injury, you make sure they don't get up from it. I mean, do you think that has been internalized or no?
I mean, I sort of feel like sometimes, some days I think it has. I mean, this is what I think Emma was talking about earlier when she talked about the fact that they're going to reconciliation and they're not waiting for Republicans around. I mean, it certainly seems, I mean, you listen to that, you see that decision, you think, okay, these guys have figured it out. But, you know, I'm not 100% sure in that, you know, it's always hard to know when they're talking about these things publicly, what's for show and what they really think. I mean, to some extent, it makes political sense. If you're Joe Biden or you're an official of the administration, there's a value in saying, I'm open to working with the Republicans. I would like to work with the Republicans. I mean, just if there's no cost to that, right? If you could just say that,
right?
That has political virtue. There's lots of people and voters who like to hear that. In an ideal world, you would like to get a couple votes from Lisa Murkowski or Mitt Romney on a child allowance or whatever. You know, something I think that Max Baucus was a big believer in, and I think Obama too. And I don't think they're wrong about this, which is that all else equal, if you could do a bill where you get Republican buy-in, that's great, because then it's more politically resilient going forward. The hard thing is, of course, you and I know, we all now know, Obama now knows that, like, this Republican Party is just not constitutionally capable of that. I mean, occasionally you find a member, whether it's a Murkowski or a Romney, who will stand up for this issue or that issue, or, you know, on Romney on impeachment, for example. And I actually am not surprised that Romney did that, given his history. I did a lot of Romney in my book, as you know, going back to his past. But, you know, that's not who the Republican Party is right now. And there are even the ones who I think have some genuine interest in being more bipartisan or sort of governing in that sort of high-minded way are just under enormous pressure not to do that. So, you know, I guess I'm optimistic that they've learned that lesson, but it's hard to be sure. And, you know, the other thing to remember is, I think just, I do try to remind people of this, and I think this is a dynamic we saw in the Affordable Care Act fight. I think it's a dynamic we see right now on the COVID fight. It's not just about the Republicans, right? It's about those conservative Democrats. It's that 59th and 60th vote if you're in a filibuster world, or it's the 49th and the 50th vote if you're in a non-filibuster world. You know, the conversations with Joe Manchin sure sound a lot like the conversations with Ben Nelson 10 years ago to get him as the last vote on health care. And, you know, they're dealing with a whole complex set of incentives, right? I mean, does he just want to stick it to the Democratic leadership? Does he generally have conservative views, or does he actually really want to be a team player? But he's in a state that voted for Trump by 30 points. I will say this, I've really never interviewed Joe Manchin, so my insights to him are based on what I've seen and read. But I look at Joe Manchin and I look at Joe Lieberman, and I think I'd much rather be dealing with Joe Manchin, who
agree more.
I've made this exact point absolutely a bunch of times. Yes.
Lieberman had, you know, a lot of money behind him trying to kill certain things. Manchin has more of a brand, I think, that he's going to sell. All right. Yeah. Well, Jonathan, we could talk about this. And I'd love to catch up with you again about it, because it's fascinating. The book is The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Healthcare. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Really, that was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Emma, I hope you forgive me for that. It was like walking down memory lane with Jonathan.
It was always very informative.
I mean, those battles, it all came back to me, and I think it gave me hives. Just even raising the idea of Joe Lieberman, who kept it got to the point where people were saying, like, well, maybe if the, you know, they would call them liberals or the left or the left flank of the Democratic Party pushed this as a head fake to Joe Lieberman, he would be against that. You know, maybe if we came out against the public option, Joe Lieberman would be like, let's do it. I mean, he was that type of guy. But we will catch up with more tomorrow. We're out of time. We will see you tomorrow. Did you call me Martha? What?
No. Okay. In the chat, I said, because we had limited time, I said, gotta be quick. Gotta be quick, Martha. That's my one of my favorite moments from the Trump presidency with Martha McSally.
Oh, right. Right. Yeah.
Gotta be quick. Yeah. No one cares. No one cares what you have to say. Quick, Martha.
So, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, and Nomi will be joining us. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You get more content in the fun half. You also get the free show free of commercials. I mean, what could be better? It's your support that makes it possible. Also, check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. And don't forget the AM Quickie, available at amquickie.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And today on the Nomi Key Show.
Hello. Today on the Nomi Key Show, we have the one and only Ben Dixon.
Yay.
Very fun. It's been a while.
Buddy Ben.
And then later we have Joshua Con Russell and Lance from the Surfs. It's a very bro-y day.
Very bro-y day.
Very bro-y day.
Start off your week.
The inverse of the Majority Report. Very, like yin and yang.
There you go. There you go. It takes all types, folks. And so check that out. What time does that your show play, Nomi?
It starts at 3 p.m. Eastern right here on the YouTubes and on Twitch at twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. Very catchy.
It's really flowing.
And on the Patreon.
Also, don't forget, check out the Antifada. They're doing 3 Twitch streams a week at twitch.tv/TheAntifada, as well as patreon.com/TheAntifada. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
I talked to historian Peter Lindbaugh about his new book, Red Round Globe Hot Burning, about the age of the enclosure of the commons, resistance to that enclosure, and how it coincides with the Anthropocene and climate destruction. So check that interview out. It came out last week, Thursday, on the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, which you should go subscribe to.
I understand that you blushed during that interview. You were so nervous.
I wouldn't. Well, if that would get people to go watch the interview, then yes, I blush during the interview.
You do it, man.
Matt threw up. Matt threw up, actually. So everyone's got to tune in to see that.
Yeah, it was like the Jordan flu game, but with my nervousness. And so it's me talking to Peter Lindbaugh.
All right, folks. We'll take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number.
Quick.
We will see you.
Quick, Martha.
Fun half, Martha. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa.
I had my my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.